you, Monica, and thank you very much for the invitation to speak at this conference. So let me start with a short outline of the talk. So I'll start by recalling or defining what are isoparametric inequalities, and recall certainly the role that they play in the field of asymptotic geometric analysis. Okay, I'll then also recall the connection of these isoparametric inequalities to Sobolev and concentration inequalities, both in a general setting and also in the presence of some convexity assumptions. Okay, and the main goal of this talk actually is going to be to survey some tools for deducing, transferring, and analyzing the stability of these isoparametric and Sobolev inequalities under some semi-convexity assumptions. I'll explain exactly what I mean by this. Okay, so let me introduce our setup. So omega d mu will stand for a general measure metric space. So omega d is just some separable metric space, and mu is always going to stand for some Borel probability measure. So I'm always going to assume that we're normalizing our measures to have total mass equal to 1. And the picture which you should keep in mind is that when omega is some subdomain of a Riemannian manifold, say smooth, connected, oriented, that d is the induced disk distance on this manifold, and that our measure mu has some nice density with respect to a Riemannian volume form restricted onto omega. Okay. So what are isoparametric inequalities? Well, they compare between the measure mu of a Borel set A and some notion which tries to capture some boundary measure of the set. And the notion that we're going to use is the so-called Minkowski's exterior boundary measure, which you know here by mu superscript plus of A. And here's the definition. Okay, you simply take your set A, you enlarge it by a distance of epsilon, of course, with respect to the metric D. You take the measure of that and you subtract the measure of the original set A. And at this point, you're measuring this strip, which is marked here in green. Okay, you divide by the width of the strip by epsilon, and you take the limit inferior as epsilon goes to 0. Okay, and if you think about this for a few moments, you realize that this is indeed a very natural generalization of the usual notion of surface area from our familiar Euclidean smooth setting to this general measure metric space setting. Let me just remark that the type of boundary measure that one gets only represents the part of the boundary of A which lies in the interior of omega. This part marked in red. So in particular, this part, which overlaps with the boundary of omega itself, is not accounted for. Okay. Now, at this point, a useful function to introduce is a so-called isoparametric function, a profile of R space, denoted here by I. This is a function defined on the interval 0, 1. Remember that 1 is the total measure of R space. And it takes a real number of V in this interval and gives back I of V, which is defined as follows. It's simply the infimum over all boundary measures of sets having measure exactly equal to V. Okay, so in other words, I of V is simply the best lower bound on boundary measures of sets having measure equal to V. Okay. Now, typically, the boundary measure of a set is just equal to the boundary measure of the complement of the set, as this picture suggests, right? This part in red certainly looks the same. Of course, the topological boundary in the interior of the set and its complement is the same. Nevertheless, the boundary measure can in principle be different because, remember, we're taking the limit from the exterior side, which could be different. But nevertheless, in some sense, for most sets A, this limit turns out to be the same, and therefore the function I just inherits this symmetry. So I at the point 1 minus V is equal to I of V. Okay, just by taking a complement of the set. Therefore, whenever we talk about isoparametric inequalities, it's just going to be enough to restrict the sets having measures smaller than 1/2. Otherwise, just take a complement of the set, right? And equivalently, anytime we talk about I, I'm just going to think about I as defined on the interval 0, 1/2. Okay? Good. So what is the motivation to study isoparametric inequalities from the point of view of asymptotic geometric analysis? Well, one motivation is the following problem. So see that you're given some convex bounded domain K in Rn. And as our measure metric space, consider the following triplet. Take your domain K and endow it with the usual Euclidean metric. Okay. And as your measure, take the uniform measure on K, just Lebesgue measure normalized to be a probability measure. And define the following so-called Cheeger constant of K, which is just the minimum of I of V divided by V, where V ranges over this interval 0, 1/2. Okay? In other words, this is simply the best constant in the kind of linear lower bound on I of V on this interval. And if we recall the definition of I of V, I'm just repeating this, this is the same as saying that this is the infimum over all linear ratios of boundary measure divided by measure for all sets having measures smaller than 1/2. Just repeating the definition. A priori, it's not clear that the infimum is actually attained, but it is attained. Okay, there is a minimizing set here, and this is actually a minimum. Okay, so if this is our convex set K, okay, let's assume that the set on which this linear ratio is minimal, let's say it looks something like this. This is set A. Okay, we know many things about this minimizer, things I don't want to describe, but certainly in general it'll have some curvature. It will be curved like that. Okay? And here comes a very bold conjecture due to Kanan, Lovas, and Szymanowicz from the 90s, which conjecture that actually, let's assume you don't care about the minimizer itself, but let's assume you only care about this value. Okay? And let's assume that you just want to get an estimate on this value, which is up to a factor, up to some constant. Let's say up to a constant of 100 or a million. The point is that this constant has to be a dimension-independent universal constant. In other words, this constant should not depend on k or on the dimension n. So just some number. Then, if you just don't mind losing this constant factor, then the conjecture is that it's enough to only consider in this minimum only half spaces A. Okay? Just half spaces. Just consider a set which looks like this. Okay? Basically corresponding to our intuition that the best way to cut a convex set is by using a knife, straight knife. Okay? That's a very bold conjecture, and indeed it is connected to various under conjectures, fundamental conjectures in asymptotic geometric analysis. It's known that it implies so-called thin shell conjecture and the slicing conjecture. I won't describe what these are. It's irrelevant for the rest of the talk. Just to show you the connections, let me mention just the connection to the slicing problem is due to Kickball and Hildan and Clartag. Okay, some additional motivation to study these inequalities. Well, there's some classical connections between isoperimetric inequalities, and they usually imply some sort of associated Sobolev inequality, which in turn usually implies some sort of concentration inequality. Okay? So we all know what are Sobolev inequalities, and if we don't, then I'll recall in a second. Let me start with concentration inequalities. Okay? Another name for those would be large deviation inequalities. So this is the requirement that for any positive number r, and for any set A having measure at least 1/2, if you take an r extension of your set A, okay, and look at the measure of the complement, right? Whatever is left outside, this thing has to be bounded from above uniformly for all such sets A, depending only on a function of R. Okay, this is what's called concentration inequality. Hopefully, this function of R decays to zero at some nice rate. Okay, this is kind of a manifestation of the fact that of the requirement that measure is concentrated around sets having measure 1/2. Okay, hence the name. Let me just emphasize that, from their very definition, by definition, concentration inequalities are only meaningful in the large, whenever R is big enough, and in particular may not provide any information when R is small. Okay, this is in a sharp contrast to isoperimetric inequalities, which are basically infinitesimal inequalities, right? We were taking the limit as the extension epsilon was going to zero. Here this inequality may only be meaningful whenever R is big enough. Okay, and also for future reference, let me also remark that an equivalent way to formulate concentration inequalities is by using one Lipschitz function. This is simply equivalent to the requirement that the measure of all points where f deviates more than r from its median with respect to mu decays like k of r. Okay, it's completely equivalent by passing to level sets of the function. Okay, so this is an equivalent formulation. Let's see some examples where this hierarchy can be seen. Some well-known examples. First example is that of a linear isoperimetric inequality, okay, a linear lower bound on I as a function of V. This is exactly as in the KLS conjecture. Okay, the best constant here we call the Cheeger constant. And a linear isoperimetric inequality happens in various situations, like for expander graphs. Okay, it also happens in hyperbolic space. And more importantly, maybe for us, it happens when you take the usual Rn and you equip it with a log concave density. Okay, so I don't know, I think I'm the fifth or sixth speaker today, and somehow this word hasn't been mentioned. So I guess I should write that log concave function just means that it's a function of the form e to the minus v, where v is convex. Okay? Okay. So if we have a linear isoperimetric inequality, it's known by results of Cheeger, so-called Cheeger's inequality, or actually also independently Mazzia, that this always implies a Poincaré or a spectral gap inequality, which relates between the L2 norm of the gradient of F and the square root of the variance of F. Okay, and if the best constant here is D, or this is satisfied with a constant D, this is satisfied with constant D over 2. Okay, and this factor of 2 is actually known to be sharp. Okay, that's Cheeger's inequality. It's also known by results of Gromov and Vitali-Milman that Poincaré inequality, vector gap inequality, always implies exponential concentration. So here the decay of K of R is rather fast. It's like exponential of minus R. And we see that the same constant D appears here in front. And here this C is just some number. Okay, as all the constants in my talk is just a number whose value I didn't bother to write down. Okay, that's one example of this hierarchy. Another example is this line. So we start off with the isoperimetric inequality, which is satisfied on Gaussian space. Okay, simply take our n, equip it with a Gaussian measure. In this case, it's again a classical result that it's known we have a precise formula for what the isoperimetric profile is. But if we just care about the asymptotic behavior, the asymptotics in V, you can calculate and see that this is looks like V times square root of log 1 over V. So just a tiny logarithmic improvement over the linear isoperimetric inequality, right? But it has some dramatic consequences. So first of all, it's known by arguments of Ledoux and Bechner that this implies a log Sobolev inequality. So this is a relation between the L2 norm of the gradient of F and the square root of the entropy of F squared. Okay, this is just recalling what the entropy is. Okay, log Sobolev inequality is rather useful for many, many applications, probability, and statistical mechanics, robotic theory, and recently also Ricci flow. But okay, anyway, it's well studied. And lastly, it's known that the log Sobolev inequality always implies, by argument of Herbst, a Gaussian concentration, which means that K decays now even faster. It decays like e to the minus r squared. Okay, so we see that even a tiny logarithmic improvement here leads to a much faster decay. So this is why we're going to fight over logarithmic factors later on. Okay, so let me remark that all of the implications that you see here, this slide, in general, the reverse implications are in general false due to the existence of potential bottlenecks in your space. Either in the geometry of the space, so maybe the domain, our domain maybe looks like this, has a kind of narrow bottleneck, or in the bottleneck in the measure mu. So if the measure mu looks like this, okay, then if you play around with these types of counterexamples, then you see that reverse implications simply do not hold in general. However, in the presence of some convexity assumptions, which I'll define in the next slide, it turns out that all of these levels are actually equivalent within dimension-independent universal constants. Okay, we'll see this in the next slide, but in particular, it turns out that the best constant here is simply equivalent, it's the same up to some factor of 10 or something like that, to the best constant here. The KLS conjecture, and the best constant here is, of course, it's well known to be the square root exactly of the spectral gap of the Laplacian associated with this problem with Neumann boundary conditions. So the KLS conjecture was formulated in terms of this constant, but we can therefore completely equivalently reformulate it in terms of this constant. And then basically the KLS conjecture is the conjecture that you don't have to test arbitrary functions to find out the best constant here. If you just want to get an estimate on this constant to within dimension-independent factors, it's enough to test linear functionals. Okay, that's the reformulation of the KLS conjecture. And that's if true, that's a very fundamental statement, because for convex sets, we know everything about the behavior of linear functionals. Okay? And this conjecture would therefore imply that you know everything about the spectral gap, because you know how to test what's going on for linear functionals. Okay, so that's it for motivation. Now, what is this hierarchy reversal that I mentioned in the presence of convexity assumptions? So basically, the claim is that you can reverse this implication and obtain a complete equivalence. Let me describe to you the setting in which this statement is true. So again, we're going to work only in the Riemannian setting. D is going to be the induced geodesic distance. Omega is going to be assumed to be a geodesically convex subdomain of the manifold. And our measure mu will be assumed to have the density of the form exponential of minus psi with respect to Riemannian volume, such that the following Bakri-Emery curvature dimension condition is satisfied. Okay? This is the requirement that the Ricci curvature plus the Riemannian Hessian of our potential psi, you add these two things as two tensors, And the requirement as this has to be as two tensor greater or equal to minus kappa times the metric, where kappa is some non-negative parameter. Okay? If you don't like manifolds, then you can just forget about the manifold setting. Think of Rn, in which case Ricci curve is just zero. Okay? And the condition is just a lower bound on the Hessian of psi. Has to be bound from below by minus kappa times the identity matrix, pointwise. Okay? And there are two cases here. Basically, the case where kappa equals zero, in which case we can say more, as we will see. Okay? This is simply the case where psi is assumed to be convex in the Euclidean setting, right? And this is where, what I'm going to call the convex case, or I'm going to say that our convexity assumptions are satisfied. And the typical case here is, therefore, when the measure mu is log concave, right? Because psi is convex. So this is the convex case. When kappa is strictly bigger, I'll call this the semi-convex case. And the prototypical example to think of is that we have a measure which may have some dip, so-called double well potential, but this dip has to be controlled. The second derivative has to be bounded from below. Okay? So these are the two cases in which I claim that we have a dimension-independent hierarchy reversal. Okay? Now, actually, the fact that this hierarchy can be reversed originates to the work of Boozer in the 80s. And he noticed that, actually, if you start with the Sobolev level for some particular inequality, the Poincaré inequality, then in the semi-convex setting, you can actually go back. Okay, and this was then generalized by Ledoux, Bakri-Ledoux, and we've also had contributions in this direction, starting from here. But perhaps our main realization is that, actually, you don't have to start on this level. You can start from the weakest level, from the concentration level, and complete the equivalence. Go all the way to the strongest level. Okay, so now I'd like to present kind of briefly our main results in this direction. I've spoken about these results in the past, so I don't want to give details about this, and I want in this talk to concentrate on applications. Okay, so I'll go over this rather briefly. Okay, so let's start with the convex case, where the lower bound is zero. Okay, the first result is that if you start with the weakest possible concentration inequality that you can imagine, it always implies, in the convex setting, a linear isoparametric inequality. Okay, and let's see what the theorem reads. Okay, reads as follows. So assume that you have some constant lambda naught, which you should think of as being slightly smaller than 1/2. Okay, and assume that you have another constant R naught, which could be potentially very large. Okay, and assume that if you start with any set having measure 1/2, if you take its R naught extension, look at the measure of the complement, well, of course, the measure of the complement has to be smaller or equal to 1/2, because you start off with a set having measure 1/2, right? But let's assume that it's strictly smaller than 1/2. Let's assume it's smaller than lambda naught, okay? Then the conclusion is that immediately you have a linear isoparametric inequality, okay? And actually, this constant here in front is best possible with respect to the parameters lambda naught and R naught, as you can check for an example. Okay, so this theorem had several manifestations, several incarnations, kind of, but this is the best, kind of latest version, which is best possible with respect to all parameters. So indeed, the weakest possible concentration that you can imagine always implies a linear isoparametric inequality, which we just saw a few slides ago, that the linear isoparametric inequality always implies exponential concentration. So just by knowing something, a tiny bit of information, in the convex setting, always you get upgraded to exponential concentration. Okay, that's the first result. So the next step would be to ask, okay, but let's assume that our initial information is that you have actually even stronger than exponential concentration. Okay, maybe then you can deduce a stronger than linear isoparametric inequality. And indeed, this is precisely the statement of our next result. Stronger than exponential concentration implies a stronger than linear isoparametric inequality. And precisely the result is as follows. Assume that K of R is bounded from above by e to the minus some function alpha of R. And alpha, you may think of alpha as some function which increases faster than linearly. Okay? Then we obtain, in the convex case, we obtain the following isoparametric inequality. I of V is bounded from below by V times some function of log 1 over V. These are precisely the logarithmic factors I was mentioning before. And we see here two constants. The first constant is just some number, okay, dimension independent. And the second one is, again, dimension independent. But the point is it depends very mildly on alpha. Okay? So first point to emphasize is that it's dimension independent. And second point is that indeed, if you check in examples, you see that concentration implies back the right. This is exactly the right isoparametric inequality in the sense that this guy always implies the other guy. So we just get an equivalence. Okay. For example, if you check what happens with if you start with a Gaussian concentration, so alpha r equals r squared, you plug a quadratic function alpha here, you get exactly v times square root of log 1 over v. You exactly get Gaussian isoparametric inequality, just recalling the example that we saw before. So we get a complete equivalence. Okay, so these are the results in the convex case. What can we say in the semi-convex case when kappa is strictly positive? And here the result is that a stronger than Gaussian concentration always implies a stronger than Gaussian isoparametric inequality. And the precise result is that assume that, again, we have a concentration inequality, but assume in addition that the following growth condition is satisfied. So we're going to demand that alpha grows at least quadratically in R, but also the constant here in front is going to be very important. It has to be kappa times delta naught. Kappa is our parameter which controls which serves as a lower bound for curvature. And delta naught has to be a constant which is strictly bigger than 1/2. Okay? Then concentration plus this growth condition implies exactly the same isoparametric inequality that we've seen before. Okay? But now, of course, the dimension independent constants depend on the additional parameters that we added, delta naught and kappa. Okay? Now you may wonder, okay, why do you need this additional growth condition? Before that, you didn't need this growth condition. Maybe this result holds true without it. But actually, this growth condition is necessary even in the one-dimensional case. This is not a phenomenon of high dimension. This is just a fact of life. You can see it in one-dimensional case. And this is due to an example due to Chen and Wang. Basically, our result says that whenever delta naught is strictly bigger than 1/2, concentration implies isoparametric inequality. And they constructed a series of examples where for any delta naught strictly smaller than 1/2, you have concentration, but you do not have any isoparametric inequality of this sort. This means that actually 1/2 is a sharp threshold. Okay? And actually, intuitively, it's easy to explain. It just means that you need to have enough concentration to compensate for the negative curvature. Okay, so these are the results. And in this talk, I would like to concentrate on applications. Okay? Let me go over this. So this is basically our results. Everything is equivalent under the semi-convexity assumptions. What can you deduce from this? Well, first of all, you can deduce all previously known results, which were unfortunately dimension-dependent, results due to Kanilova-Shimonovich, Wang, Bobkov, Bart, and Bartin-Kolesnikov. Let me not give details here. I'm seeing I'm a little behind on time. And also results by people from classical Riemannian geometry like Berard, Bessot, Galois, Li, and Yao. Maybe I'll just describe this case. Well, here, these authors, from a classical Riemannian geometry point of view, it's very natural to impose an upper bound of the diameter of the space. Okay, and in this case, if we're in this compact setting, I claim that we have a trivial concentration inequality, right? Because if you take any set and you enlarge it by a distance which is bigger than the diameter, of course you have nothing left outside, right? So obviously K of R is equal to zero whenever R is bigger than the diameter. So you can just use this thing, plug it into our formula, and you obtain an isoparametric inequality, recovering previous results. And actually, if you do this carefully, you can actually obtain the precise sharp isoparametric inequality, not up to a factor of 100, but the right constant as well. Maybe I mentioned something like this in the abstract, but actually I was too optimistic. This is a subject for a whole different talk. Okay, and we can actually generalize all of these previous approaches to the Riemannian setting because some of these approaches were confined to the Euclidean setting using a technique called localization. Anyway, we can generalize this even further. Okay, what else can we do with this type of these types of results? Well, we can also use the known concentration results on the unit ball of LP in Rn, which are due to Shechtman and Zinn. And just plug this into our formula. We have out-of-the-box concentration inequality. We plug it in, and we obtain an isoparametric inequality automatically. And this recovers a result for P between 1 and 2 here. This recovers a previous result of Sasha Sodin, who actually had to do some computation to work for it. But now this is completely automatic. You can do other various things. You can, for example, introduce another level here in the middle, so-called transport entropy inequalities or Talagrand-type inequalities. And since everything is an equivalence, you can say something about these. But in this talk, I would like to talk about the stability of isoparametric and sublevel inequalities under measure perturbation. So here's the question, basically. Assume you have some space and some measure on the space. And let's assume that you know that some, let's say, a log sublevel inequality is satisfied on this measure metric space. And now someone comes and perturbs the measure a little bit. Okay? And the question is, does this perturbed measure satisfy the log sublevel inequality? And if so, what is the quantitative dependence on the perturbation? Okay? This is precisely the type of question which is actually being asked by people in statistical mechanics, in which case the log sublevel inequality is actually important. And in fact, the dimension independence is also crucial for that community because they like to take the dimension which corresponds to the number of particles to infinity. This corresponds to whatever, the thermodynamic limit. Okay, so what can you do in this case? So if the perturbation the measure undergoes is kind of trivial, then yes, you can analyze everything on the sublevel level or on the isoparametric level. But what happens if the perturbation is somehow not so trivial? It turns out that it's very hard to see what's going on these levels. And here's our idea, very simple. Well, you can always pass to the concentration level. That's always true. You can always do this for free. So let's pass to the concentration level and try to analyze the stability on the level of concentration. Okay? It turns out that on this level, analyzing the perturbation is very easy. It's usually an exercise. And then after you figure out what's happening to your stability here on this level, you can use, if you have some semi-convexity assumptions, you can use this and go back to the isoparametric or sublevel level, obtaining a stability result for those levels. Okay? So it's a very simple idea, but it gives some results. So what we're going to do is analyze the case of the convex case first and show some stability results for the Cheeger or spectral gap constant. They're just equivalent, we know this already, with respect to all kinds of perturbations. And then later on we'll do some more general inequalities. Okay, so let me start with the convex case and let me start with the spectral gap. Okay, so assume you have two log concave measures on Rn, probability measures on Rn, and assume that they're close in the total variation distance. Okay, so let me just recall that total variation distance is 1/2 times the L1 norm of the difference between the densities of the two measures. Okay, now just by the triangle inequality, of course, this thing, like the triangle, we have probability measures, so this thing is always smaller or equal to 1, always. But let's assume that it's smaller or equal to 1 minus epsilon. And epsilon is some strictly positive parameter. Okay? Then the claim is that if the first measure satisfies the spectral gap inequality, then the second measure also satisfies the spectral gap inequality. And in fact, the dependence here, it's linear in L here. And you get an additional constant which depends only on epsilon. It's dimension independent, as usual. Okay? First type of result. And the second type of result is exactly the same, only now we're using not total variation, but the so-called relative entropy of mu2 with respect to mu1, or sometimes this is called the Kullback-Leibler divergence. This is the definition. It's simply the entropy of the derivative mu2 over mu1 with respect to mu1. Okay? So assume that this thing is finite. It's bounded from above by some parameter h. Then, if the first measure satisfies spectral gap inequality, then so does the second one with an additional constant depending only on h. And actually, you can also analyze the dependence here on epsilon and h. And these constants, it's completely explicit. And it turns out that it's essentially best possible up to a dimension-independent constant. And also, let me emphasize that this stability result is really a consequence of our convexity assumption. Okay, this is completely false without the convexity assumption. Okay, so this is really some property of convexity, the stability under perturbation. Right, so what can we do with this type of result? Well, first of all, something which I always like to mention, we can start with a space which you understand, like the LP unit balls of Rn, which I just mentioned. We know exactly what's going on there. And you can take some perturbation of those. And the claim is that, if you take some convex perturbation for which the volume is somehow preserved, you can just check the total variation distance, you can calculate it, and you get some dependency on epsilon, and you can just transfer whatever you know on BPN, you can transfer to the perturbed BPN. And I think this is non-trivial even if you start with the Euclidean ball. Okay, take your Euclidean ball. We know exactly what the Speckler gap is. There's actually a formula. Okay, and now let's assume that let me draw to you a convex perturbation. Let's start cutting it with some half spaces. Okay, start cutting it with many, many half spaces. Okay, and look at whatever is left. This guy. You can actually use almost an exponential in the dimension number of half spaces here. So the geometry of the Euclidean ball is completely deformed. You get some very ugly convex set here inside. And the claim is that if the volume of this interior guy is proportional to the volume of the Euclidean ball that you started off from, turns out that this new guy and the original Euclidean ball have the same spectral gap, up to a factor of 100. Okay? So this tells you that if you're in the category of convex sets, actually geometry almost doesn't play a role as far as spectral gap is concerned. The only thing that plays a role is the preservation of volume. Okay, so that's one type of thing you can do with this result. Another type of thing is you can actually give some bounds. You can analyze the spectral gap of a convex set K under some symmetry assumption on K. This was done by Boas-Clartag for the case of an unconditional convex set, so a set which is invariant with respect to flipping the sign of the coordinates. Okay? And recently this was generalized by Bart and Dario Cordero-Erskine, okay? To more general symmetry assumptions. Another thing you can do is, some other people have used the stability results for other things. Let me move on. This takes care of a situation where you can control total variation on relative entropy, but what happens if your two measures have disjoint supports, okay? Or more generally, if they're mutually singular? In this case, you cannot use these results because this guy is just infinity and this guy is just one. Okay, so you need some other notion of proximity. And here's our next result. Assume that the L1 Wasserstein distance is actually controlled. So let me recall that this is simply the optimal transportation cost of transporting the first measure to the second measure, optimal in the sense that you're trying to minimize the L1 average distance traversed, okay? The W1 metric. Okay, assume, and of course, if you have a measure here and you have another measure here, even though they have disjoint supports, the transportation cost is finite. So assume that this is bounded by some constant W, and the claim is that if the first measure satisfies spectral gap inequality, then the second measure, which we assume is log concave, also satisfies the spectral gap inequality. Now the dependence, notice, is no longer linear, but still it's kind of the right thing to do is to normalize by L times W squared. Okay? This is the result. Let me try to give you a proof, even though I'm running low on time. At least one proof should be seen, right? So let's denote by dpq the best constant in the following PQ Poincaré equality relating between the LP norm of F, after you subtract from it its median, and the LQ norm of the gradient of F. Okay? Here's some facts. Okay? So first of all, the D11 constant, P equals 1, Q equals 1, is just the same as the Cheeger constant that we defined before. Okay? This is well known and can be seen by passing two level sets of the function. Also, D22, well, if you're using the L2 norm here and here, this is almost the Poincaré inequality, almost the spectral gap inequality, right? Except that we're using the median here, not the expectation, right? But that's insignificant. So these are essentially the same. Okay, so D22 is Poincaré constant or square root of the spectral gap. And lastly, the constant what we're going to be interested in is the D1 infinity constant. Okay, now when one is using Q equals infinity here, the L infinity norm of the gradient of F is simply the Lipschitz constant of F. So basically, we're just looking at Lipschitz functions. And remember that we said that concentration is equivalent about a property of tail decay of Lipschitz functions, right? So basically, D1 infinity is measuring some type of weak concentration inequality, okay? That's the only thing we need to remember here. And last fact we need is the following dual characterization of the W1 distance due to Monch, Kantorovich, and Rubinstein, if I'm not mistaken. And this is simply, by duality, this is simply equal to the supremum over all one Lipschitz functions f when you integrate f with respect to mu1 minus mu2. Okay, well-known facts if you're if you ever worked with this distance. And now let me try to give you a proof of this, or at least a sketch. So let's start with any one Lipschitz function f and try to evaluate this expression. Okay, this integral with respect to mu 2 of f minus its median with respect to mu 2. Now, of course, this number is just minimizes, among all other numbers, this expression, right? The median is exactly the one which minimizes the integral of the absolute value, right? So let's replace this number by some other number. Let me use the median of f with respect to mu 1. I can do this. And now let's write mu 2 as mu 2 minus mu 1 plus mu 1. Okay, didn't do anything. And now let's bound this guy by this characterization, right? This is still a one Lipschitz function, and I'm integrating with respect to mu 2 minus mu 1. So this is bounded by the one L1 Wasserstein distance. And this integral, this part, by definition, f is a one Lipschitz function. This is, by definition, bounded by 1 over the d1 infinity constant of mu 1. Okay? And now taking supremum over all one Lipschitz functions here, we obtain, by definition, the 1 over d1 infinity constant of mu 2. And I'm just copying what's written here. The only thing I changed, I made this even weaker. We can always pass from 1 infinity just by Jensen's inequality to a 2-2 constant. Okay, this is only smaller, so this guy only becomes bigger. Okay, so I'm really not doing anything here. So I haven't used convexity at this point at all. And now comes the only part where I use the convexity assumptions on V2. Because we said a weakest concentration is equivalent to a linear isoperimetric inequality, right? In other words, you can check the d1 infinity constant is just equivalent to the d11 constant, and it's equivalent to the d22 constant. So I can replace this with a d22 constant, and that's it. We have an inequality for spectral gaps. Basically, if you translate this into, you get what's written here. Okay, so that's just kind of give you an idea that playing around with on the concentration level, here the concentration level was, we were playing around with the D1 infinity constant. The stability for the D1 infinity constant is trivial, and then you pass back to the stability for the spectral gap. So that's the result. Let me not talk about, I don't have time, so you can also analyze the stability of the spectral gap with respect to not just Lipschitz maps, that's trivial, but with respect to on average Lipschitz maps. Let me skip this part. And let me talk about stability of more general inequalities, not just spectral gap, but actually more general ones, in which case we need to use more restrictive perturbations. We cannot do all the stuff that we did before. Let me formulate everything for the log subtle of inequality, just because it's more the most useful for applications, but the results are completely general, applied to general subtle of an isoperimetric inequality. So let me start by recalling a classical lemma due to Hawley and Strook, which they proved in the context of statistical mechanics. Assume that you have two probability measures, let's say on Rn, although that's insignificant, okay, so that the potentials V2 minus V1 are bounded above and below. They have bounded oscillation. Okay, then if the first measure satisfies a log subtle of inequality, so does the second measure. Okay, the dependence here is linear in L, and you get the price to pay is e to the minus the oscillation. Okay, two-line proof. Okay, it's really a lemma. And here comes our result, which states the following. You can simply forget about the upper bound. Okay, you don't need the upper bound. You just need a lower bound on V2. But the price to pay is that we're also going to assume that the Hessian of V2 is bounded from below by minus kappa. Okay, so you need some curvature control. Then the claim is that if you satisfy a strong enough log subtle of inequality, strong enough means that L has to be strictly bigger than kappa over 2. Okay, and this requirement that you have a strong enough inequality is precisely due to the fact that we had to require this growth condition in our concentration inequality. It's precisely for this reason. So a strong enough log subtle of inequality always implies a log subtle of inequality for the perturbed measure with some constant here which depends on all the parameters, L, kappa, and D minus. Okay? In general, the dependence is very nasty. Okay, it's not as nice as here. But actually, if kappa equals 0, if your perturbed measure is actually log concave, then you can actually use a linear dependence here, L times, and actually, you get a linear dependence on D minus. So actually, it's a kind of dramatic improvement over the Hawley-Strook lemma, because here you had exponential dependence on the oscillation, and here you have linear dependence. Much, much better. Of course, this is due to the fact that we have more assumptions. We're in the log concave case here. And also, let me remark that this is completely false all of this stability is completely false without assuming this curvature lower bound. Okay. And let me give you just an innocent-looking corollary, which I think was not known before. So assume that you have a log concave measure, okay, and you have some convex set in Rn having mu1 measure equal to p, and you define mu2 to be the conditioning of mu1 onto this event. So you just restrict onto the set A and normalize to have a probability measure. Then the claim is that if the big measure satisfies the log Sobolev inequality, so does the second, the restricted measure, and the dependency here is actually pretty good, logarithmic in 1 over p. Okay, and even this kind of very natural question, I don't know how to prove this without going through this general result. Okay, the usual criticism is, okay, what happens if mu1 and mu2 have disjoint supports? We cannot apply our result in this case. And now in the last few minutes, I would like to introduce a new metric on measures, which takes care of this situation. And I think it's interesting, may be of independent interest. So let me define the Psi 1 Lipschitz metric on the class of exponentially integral probability measures, let's say on Rn, doesn't matter. Okay, I'll denote this by W tilde Psi 1. Okay, first of all, you can show that this is a metric. And so this is the formula. You take the supremum over this type of integral. Here we are integrating with respect to mu1. Here we're integrating with respect to mu2, and we denote by the Lipschitz constant of the function f. Take the supremum over all such creatures. Okay? So this w suggests that there may be some connection to optimal transport, but I have to say I don't know. We'll get to this in a second. The point is that, first of all, this is a metric, and second of all, it's actually a strong metric. It's stronger than the w1 distance we've seen before, and this is easy to see if you just use functions of the form epsilon times g, and let epsilon go to zero, so basically linearizing around zero, you get this W1 distance, the formula for the W1 distance due to Monch-Kantorovich-Rubinstein. Okay, so this is a stronger metric. It should have some relation, but at the moment for me it's unclear, to another metric which is connected to optimal transport. Let me call this W of Psi1, and this is the optimal transport cost with respect to the Ehrlich norm Psi 1 associated with the measure mu 1. So we've seen the definition of Ehrlich norm, right, in Peter's talk. And the Psi 1 function here I'm using is just e to the t minus 1. Okay? So usually we work with LP norms, right? This corresponds to the function t to the power of p, but this is the Psi 1 norm. So these two should be connected, but there's some unclear relation. So there's some interesting questions here which I would like to pose to you. I'm very interested in this. Is there some connection between W tilde Psi 1 and W Psi 1? Is there some optimal transport interpretation? And also, what would be very natural is to maybe ask, is it true that if you just restrict to log concave measures, all of these metrics are actually equivalent to the W1 metric? That would also be very natural, but I don't know. Okay, my last slide is we're going to see why this and definition is useful for anything. So this is the definition, recall, and now it's just an exercise to show that actually concentration inequalities are stable with respect to this metric. Okay, and this is why I came up with this metric and why we think it's important. Okay, and here's the idea of the proof. Basically, you just formulate your concentration inequality using the Laplace transform. Okay, so you define the Laplace transform of your measure. It's a function of some parameter lambda as the supremum over all such integrals involving lambda over all one Lipschitz function f centered. Okay, this is just kind of an equivalent rewriting of a concentration inequality, and all the information about concentration is contained in this function as a function of lambda. And now you see that how the connection goes. So it's kind of it's a two-line exercise to show that if you can control this guy, you control the stability of the Laplace transform, and then you get some stability for concentration. So you get a stability kind of for free on the concentration level using this metric, and as usual we can transfer this stability to the level of isoperimetry or Sobolev inequalities. And let me formulate our last result for this talk, which is that if indeed you can control this Psi 1 Lipschitz metric for your two measures, and the second measure is semi-convex, then a strong enough log Sobolev inequality for the first measure implies a log Sobolev inequality for the second measure, again, some nasty dependence here, but in the log concave case, when kappa equals zero, you actually get the exact same answer we saw before, but for the W1 distance for the spectral gap. Okay, so there is some connection here which is at this moment not so clear to me. So I hope that I gave some survey of some tools that we have today for transferring, you know, spectral gap inequalities and log subtle inequalities, and hopefully these tools will allow us to progress further in the study of the KLS conjecture from on our community side and maybe on the questions from the from the community of statistical mechanics. Okay, so I think I'll stop here and thank you for your attention.